Clintan frowned, stroking his chin meditatively, eyes half closed for several seconds. "You know," he said thoughtfully, "that might not be such a bad idea. Letting Corus carry the blame for it, I mean." He smiled thinly. "He and Anvil Rock and Tartarian all work together with Hector, after all. Saddling him with responsibility because he saw it as an opportunity to buy Caleb's favour the same way they have, no doubt, would smear the two of them by association too, wouldn't it?" "It certainly might, Your Grace." "Do you think Sea Blanket could handle it?" "I think he could, but I'd rather not use him, Your Grace." "Why not? Especially if he's already in position." "Because he's too valuable, Your Grace. If I'm following your logic properly here, we need for the assassin, or for an assassin at any rate, to be taken or killed after the boy is dead. Preferably killed, I should think, if we don't want any inconvenient interrogations. I'd hesitate to use up someone as capable as Sea Blanket if we don't absolutely have to." "So who would you use instead?" "My thought at this moment is that we might use a team from the Rakurai candidates you approved but haven't assigned, Your Grace. I'm sure we could select men who would be prepared to see to it that they weren't taken alive. In fact, we have several more native-born Carizians available." Clintan cocked his head, then nodded slowly. "That would be a nice touch, wouldn't it?" he smiled unpleasantly. "Of course, it would tend to direct suspicion away from Corus." "Only in the sense that it wasn't actually his hand on the dagger, Your Grace," Reno pointed out. "As you suggested, even if he didn't strike the blow himself, he might have connived with Caleb. In fact, we might be able to help that perception along a little bit. At the appropriate time, we could instruct him to creatively weaken Davin's security to let our assassins in. Sea Blanket's in a perfect position to pass him the message when we need to, and it won't hurt a thing at that point for Corus to realize we've been watching him more closely than he thought. And after the fact, if we decide to throw Corus to the Slash Lizard, the fact that he did let the assassins, the Carizian-born assassins, into Davin's presence would be the crowning touch. And if we decided not to throw him to the Slash Lizard after all, we simply wouldn't have to mention what he did." "I like it," Clintan nodded. "All right. Pick your team. We'll see how public opinion in Coruscant reacts to Charlian's executions before we actually order them to proceed, but it won't hurt to have the pieces in position when the time comes." 2. Twingith, Duchy of Malachi, Kingdom of Dolar. Sir Gwilymanthir's eyes opened as the hand shook his shoulder. On the face of it, it was ridiculous that such a gentle summons could rouse him. Over the last 5 days and a half, he had learned to sleep despite the bone-jarring, jouncing, swaying, rumbling, grating progress of their mobile prison. Just the mind-numbing sound of steel-shod wooden wheels grinding over the hard surface of the Royal High Road should have been enough to make anything like sleep impossible. But Manthir was a lifelong seaman. He had learned to steal precious moments of sleep even in the teeth of a howling gale, and sheer exhaustion made it easier than it might have been otherwise. He had never been so tired, so worn to the bone in his entire life, and he knew it was even worse for many of his men. He looked up into Neklas Valaen's face and opened his mouth, but he had to stop and swallow twice before he could moisten his vocal cords enough to speak.
"What is it, Neklos?"
"Begging your pardon, sir, but we're coming into a town. A big one. I think it's Twingith."
I see. Manthir lay still for another moment, then reached up and grabbed one of the wagon's iron bars and used it to haul himself to his feet. He balanced there, despite the shock waves which exploded up his legs and jolted painfully in his spine with the wagon's motion. It was odd, a corner of his mind thought. Kairos highways were adequate to the kingdom's needs, but nothing like most of the mainland realms boasted. The reason for that, of course, was Howl Bay. Kairos didn't need the sort of road network the mainlanders required, because water transport was always available, and far more economical and speedy than even the best of road systems. Despite himself, Manthir had been impressed by the sheer engineering ability and years of labour it must have taken to build the Dolaran royal highroads, and their surfaces were hard and smooth, made of multiple layers of tamped gravel, rolled out, and then covered with slabs of cement. And that was what was odd. One wouldn't have thought a surface that smooth could still be uneven. Yet judging from the prison wagon's painful progress, it obviously could. He rubbed his aching, gummy eyes and peered through the bars. Niklos was right. They were approaching a sizable town or city. Once upon a time, Manthir had been accustomed to judging the size of the cities he encountered by comparison to Talisberg, yet he discovered there were others which were larger still. Chiraeth, in Chisholm, for example, or Gorath here in Dolar. This town was much smaller than that, barely a third the size of Talisberg, but it boasted fortified bastioned walls at least 20 or 30 feet tall, and there was obviously artillery atop those walls, which argued for a certain importance. And if Manthia's memory of the maps of Dolar were correct, which it might well not be since he'd been primarily interested in Dolar's coasts, this almost certainly was Twingit. And won't that be fun? He thought grimly, knees flexing as his weary body anticipated the jolts. It wasn't like being at sea, but there were some similarities. You had to go and help His Majesty kill that asshole Duke Malachi off Armageddon Reef, didn't you, Gwillem? I'll bet his loving family's been just praying for the opportunity to entertain you on your way through. Keep the crowd moving, Captain, Father Victor Tarlson said. I'm sure everyone wants to see these bastards, and I want to make sure everyone gets to see them, too. See them from close enough they can smell the vermin stink. Aye, sir. Captain Wallish Zoo touched his breastplate in salute. But behind that facade of stolid acknowledgement, his brain was busy. Over the last several days, Zoo had realized Tarlson was even more zealous than the captain had originally thought. Zhu was as orthodox and conservative as only a Harchungese could be, and he saw no reason heretics should be accorded the protections of honourable prisoners of war. Anyone who gave his allegiance to Shan Wei deserved whatever came his way, after all. On the other hand, Zhu took no particular pleasure from seeing them abused without some specific reason. He'd ordered his guardsmen to show them why they'd been wise to cooperate that very first day, but there'd been a purpose to that beating, a way to establish discipline without actually killing anyone. And, if he was going to be honest, there had been a certain personal satisfaction in it as well. Payback for what their bastard friends had done to the Navy of God and the Imperial Harchungese Navy in the Markovian Sea, if nothing else. But Tarlson sometimes seemed to have trouble remembering they were supposed to deliver their prisoners intact to the temple. Personally, Zhu estimated, they were likely to lose perhaps 1 in 5 from sheer exhaustion and privation, even under the best of conditions. But they weren't getting the best of conditions, were they? They'd been scrawny as skinned wyverns when he'd collected them from the prison hulks in Gorath, and Tarlson wasn't going out of his way to fatten them up since. Zhu suspected there was sickness among them as well, helping to gnaw away at their reserves of strength. But Talson had endorsed Bishop Executor Wilson's ban on providing the malingering bastards with healers, and the prison wagon's jarring ride was far more debilitating than Talson seemed to realize. Now they were coming into Twingith, the biggest city they'd passed through yet, and Talson's instructions made him a little nervous. It had been bad enough in some of the other villages and small towns. Zhu remembered the village where 20 or 30 men and adolescent boys had jogged along beside the prison wagons, pelting the Carisians with stones picked up from the roadside. At least one prisoner had lost an eye, and another had gone down unconscious when a rock hit him in the head. Zhu didn't know how much the blow to his skull had to do with it, but the same man had gone berserk the next afternoon and attacked a guardsman with his bare hands when he and his fellows were released from their wagon for a latrine break. Talson would just as soon have left them to foul the wagons with their own wastes, but Father Mertan, his second in command, had convinced him that at least the rudiments of Pasquale's laws of hygiene had to be observed if they didn't want the guardsmen to come under the archangel's curse as well. Zhu didn't know about that, but he had a pretty fair notion how foul the prison wagons would smell to anyone unfortunate enough to be escorting them from downwind. That was more than enough to put him on Father Merton's side of that debate, although Talson had almost changed his mind and prohibited the stops after all when the screaming Carisian got both hands around a guardsman's throat and started beating the man's head on the ground. Three more Carisians had turned on their captors as well, less from any real hope of achieving anything, Zhu thought, than out of pure instinct to aid their fellow. And despite the prisoner's half-starved condition, it had taken over 40 guardsmen to subdue the single, unlocked wagon's 20 Carisians. When it ended, 2 guardsmen were seriously injured, and the first Carisian and one of his companions were dead. 2 more had died over the next day and a half, and 6 more had received broken bones, not all of them before they were subdued. Sergeant Zadang came from one of the Empire's Bedard province in far western West Haven. Nobody was more orthodox than someone from Bedard, especially someone who'd been born a serf like Zadang. And no one was more accustomed to receiving and meting out brutality than a Bedard serf. There was no doubt in Zhu's mind that Zadang had seen to the administration of a little additional discipline on his own initiative. The captain had chosen not to make an issue out of it in this instance. First, because a little extra emphasis for the prisoners probably wouldn't hurt anything, except the prisoners, who were heretics and deserved it anyway. And second, and more to the point, because he had no doubt Talson would have supported the sergeant's actions. He had certainly brushed aside Father Merton's earlier efforts to convince him to make at least some improvements in the prisoner's condition. The argument had become heated, dangerously so, Zhu thought, before Father Victor sharply ordered Father Merton to be silent. He was hardly likely to support Zhu if he disciplined Zadang for something as minor as beating a heretic or two to death. And Talson was one of the Grand Inquisitor's favourites. Yet what worried him at the moment was less what Zadang or his own men might do, but what the good citizens of Twingith might take it into their minds to do. The convoy's progress was slow, deliberately so, to make sure there was time for crowds to gather properly in the towns along its route, and that meant there was plenty of time for broadsheets and posters to go up along the way. Literacy was much more common in Dolar than in Ha Chong, and even the most ill-educated villager could always find someone to read the latest broadsheet to him, which meant there'd also been ample opportunity for everyone along the route to discuss all the inequities of the Corisian heretics about to be found, briefly, in their midst. And as they'd drawn gradually closer to Twingith, Zhu had noticed a steadily rising level of vituperation and hatred in the broadsheets nailed to the milestones they'd passed along the way. "I wonder how much of that is the Alvarez family's doing," he thought. "From everything I've heard, they wanted the Dolarans to string these bastards up for what happened to Duke Malachi at Rock Point. And they know we've got our hands on Emperor Caleb's flag captain from that battle, too. I'll bet they really want to get their hands on him. Stupid of them, of course. Nothing they could do to him would be a patch on what the Inquisition's got waiting in Zion. But none of these damned Dolarans seem overly blessed with logic. On the other hand, the Inquisition wanted to make sure it got its hands on Gwilym Manthir. It wouldn't thank Tarlson or Captain Wallace Zhu if it didn't. And Zhu rather suspected the Grand Inquisitor himself would make his displeasure known if that happened, even if Tarlson was one of his favorites. "Forgive me, Father Victor," he said after a moment, "but I'm a little concerned over the prisoner's security." He'd started to use the word safety, but stopped himself in time. "What do you mean?" Tarlson's eyes narrowed. "Twingith is a larger city than any we've stopped in so far, Father," Zhu said in his calmest, most reasonable tone. "The crowds will be a lot thicker, and we'll be inside the city proper, surrounded by buildings and narrow streets." "And your point is, Captain?" Tarlson prompted impatiently. "As I'm sure you're aware, Father, the natural anger heresy always arouses seems to be burning especially high here in Malachi. I imagine that has a lot to do with what happened to Duke Malachi at the Battle of Rock Point. What I'm afraid of is that someone, carried away by that anger, might feel compelled to take God's justice into his own hands." "What do you mean, carried away? Carried away how?" Zhu wasn't even tempted to roll his eyes, but he found himself wishing, for far from the first time, that Father Merton was in command of the convoy. Tarlson's burning hatred for any heretic seemed to get in the way of his logical processes from time to time. "Like every time he thinks about them at all," the captain thought dryly. "Father, it's my understanding that we're supposed to deliver the heretics alive and intact to the Inquisition in Zion?" Zhu's rising inflection and raised eyebrows made the statement a politely phrased question, and Tarlson nodded impatiently. "What I'm afraid of, Father, is that feelings are running so high here in Twingith that someone's likely to stick a knife into one of them if he gets the opportunity. And in a built-up area like a city, there's a lot better chance that if some kind of mob mentality builds, they'd be able to rush my men and get through to the heretics. In that case, we could lose dozens of them, Father, in addition to the ones we're losing from natural attrition. We've already lost 8 since leaving Gorath. At that rate, we'll be lucky to get 20 of them as far as Zion to face the Inquisition." Zhu was afraid he might be being dangerously blunt, but he saw no other option. "I simply don't want to lose any of them here by allowing the crowds to get too dense or too close to the wagons." Tarlson glared at him for a moment, but then his eyes narrowed and Zhu could almost see the wheels inside his brain beginning to turn at last. Apparently the captain had finally found an argument Father Merton's appeals to the Book of Pasquale and the Holy Writ had failed to present. "Very well, Captain Zhu," the upper priest finally said. "I'll leave the security arrangements in your hands. Mind you, I want the Dolarans to have ample opportunity to bear witness to what happens to heretics. I'm firm on that point. But you're probably right. that letting them too close to the wagons would constitute an unnecessary additional risk. I'll send a messenger ahead to tell the city authorities we need to clear one of their largest market squares as a place to bivouac overnight. Then we'll set up a perimeter of what, 15 yards, 20, around the wagons themselves.
With your approval, Father. I'd feel more comfortable with 20.
Oh, very well.
Tolson waved an obviously irritated hand.
Make it 20 if you think that's necessary. And remember what I said about keeping the crowd moving so everyone gets his chance to see them.
Of course, Father. I assure you that everyone in Twingiths will have ample opportunity to see what happens to the defilers of Mother Church.
3. HMS Destiny 54 and HMS Destroyer 54. King's Harbour, Helen Island, Kingdom of Old Caris.
Vast heaving! Avast heaving!
Hector Aplin Armack shouted, and the capstan stopped turning instantly. The new model Kraken hung suspended above HMS Destiny's deck, gleaming in the sunlight, and its shadow fell across the youthful ensign. He stepped across the bar-taut fall leading back through the deck-level snatch block to the capstan, then stood, hands on hips, and glared up at the 3-ton hammer of the gun tube suspended from the mainmast pendant and the four-courses yardarm. He stood that way for several seconds before he shook his head and turned to the boatswain's mate, who'd been supervising the operation with a disgusted expression.
"Get that gun back down on the dock and rig that sling properly, Selkir," he snapped, raising his right hand and jabbing an index finger skyward.
The boatswain's mate in question was at least twice Alpin Armack's age, but he looked up, following the ensign's pointing finger, then cringed. The rope cradle secured around the gun's trunnions had managed to slip badly off-centre. The iron tube had begun to twist sideways, pulling hard against the steadying line rigged from its cascabel to the hook of the winding tackle's lower blocks, and threatening to slide completely free of the sling.
"Aye, aye, sir," he replied. "Sorry, sir. Don't know how that happened."
"Just get it back down and straighten it out," Aplin Armack said in calmer tones. Then he grinned.
"Somehow I don't think the captain would thank us for dropping that thing down on the main hatch and out of the bottom when the dockyard still hasn't turned us loose."
"No, sir, that he wouldn't,"
Selkir agreed fervently.
"Then see to it," Aplin Armack said, "because he's not going to be very happy if we don't get finished on time either."
"Aye, sir."
Selkir saluted in acknowledgement and turned back to his working party. Aplin Armack stood back, watching as the men on the capstan began cautiously turning it the other way, leaning back against the capstan bars now to break its motion as they slackened the fall. The hands, tending the guidelines and manning the forebraces, swung the yardarm back outboard, and the gun descended once more to the dock, beside which Destiny lay moored. Selkir was an unhappy man, and he made his displeasure known to the working party as it set about re-rigging the sling properly, yet there was a certain restraint in his manner, and Aplin Armack gave a mental nod of approval. The boatswain's mate was clearly more concerned with seeing to it that his men got the problem fixed and learned not to let it happen again than with pounding whoever had made the mistake this time. A good, petty officer, and Anton Selkir was just that, preferred correction to punishment whenever possible, and that was especially important given the number of green hands currently diluting Destiny's normally proficient and well-trained company. The ship had been required to give up a sizable draft of experienced seamen and petty officers during her stint in dockyard hands. In fact, she'd been raided even more heavily than many of the other ships, which were losing trained personnel to form the cadre of new ships' companies. Aplin Armack suspected Destiny's crew quality had something to do with the reason she'd been forced to give up so many more of her people than those other ships had. and he couldn't help resenting it more than a little. They probably figure the captain can always train more, he thought sourly. And I guess it's a compliment, in a backhanded sort of way. They need good people, and the captain produces good people. So obviously, the thing to do is reward him by taking them all away from him and making him go produce still more of them. It's just harvesting the natural increase. He was being unfair to the Navy, and in his calmer moments he knew it. He understood the frantic efforts the Navy was making to man its recently acquired galleons, and he couldn't quibble with the need to provide the most experienced possible cadres for the newly inducted men going into their crews. The Imperial Carisian Navy had consisted of just over 90 galleons prior to the Battle of the Markovian Sea. Now it had over 200, courtesy of its construction programs and the Navy of God and the Imperial Hachungese Navy. Manning even half those new prizes had required an enormous increase in manpower, and manpower was the Empire of Karis's greatest weakness in its confrontation with the Church of God awaiting and the huge populations of the mainland realms. It simply didn't have enough warm bodies to go around. For the first time in its history, old Karis faced the threat of being forced to resort to the sort of impressment other navies had routinely employed for centuries. The Crown had always had the authority to impress seamen, but the House of Armagh had been careful not to use it, and for good reason. The fact that the Royal Carisian Navy's galleys had been manned solely by volunteers built around solid cores of long service, highly experienced regulars, had been its most telling advantage, and they'd been willing to accept a smaller fleet than they could have built in order to maintain that qualitative edge. With every mainland realm united against the Empire, however, that was a luxury the Imperial Carisian Navy couldn't afford. It needed as many hulls as it could get, and while galleons didn't require the hundreds of rowers, galleys did. They were far bigger than even Carisian galleys had been, and much more heavily armed. Providing them with gun crews and enough trained seamen to manage their powerful sail plans drove the size of their companies up rapidly, and completely filling the establishment crew for a galleon-like destiny required approximately 400 men. With the prizes being put into commission, the Navy's galleon strength would rise to 211, which would require over 84,000 men, and that didn't even consider all of the schooners, brigs, and other light warships and dispatch vessels. Or the competition for the strength to man the Navy's shoreside establishments, or the requirements of the Marine Corps, or the Imperial Army, or the fishing fleet, or the merchant marine upon which the Empire's prosperity and very survival depended. And while the Crown was finding, somehow, all the men it needed for those requirements, the manufactories producing both the sinews of war and the goods fueling the steadily growing economy, not to mention the farms feeding the Empire's subjects, still had to be provided for somehow. So far, enlistment was managing, barely, to meet demands. But an increasing percentage of the Navy's strength was Emeraldian or Chisholmian, and even the native old Carisians coming forward boasted a lower percentage of experienced seamen. From what Erplin Armack had seen, the basic quality of the new men was just fine. They were simply less well-trained and hardened to the demands of life at sea than the Navy was accustomed to. And even with the newcomers, Destiny's official 400-man company was 43 men short. Well, he thought, watching the gun begin to rise once more, I guess having too many ships and too few experienced men is a lot better problem to have than the other way around. Sir Dominic Stainer leaned back in the window seat, one arm stretched along the top of its cushioned back and his truncated right leg stretched out in front of him, the padded peg resting on a footstool. It was almost the turn of the watch, and the cabin skylight was open, admitting the sounds of King's Harbour and the closer, quieter voices of the officer of the watch and his senior quartermaster as they discussed HMS Destroyer's log entry. The more distant cries of gulls and sea wyverns drifted down through it as well, and wavery patterns of bright light reflected into the cabin through the quarter and stern windows, gleaming on polished bookshelves, sideboards and tables. It sparkled from the cut crystal of decanters, sending rainbow ripples across the cabin as the galleon stirred gently, and the portraits of Emperor Caleb and Empress Shalian faced each other across the deck's thick carpets. Those carpets had been a gift from Empress Shalian, and their deep-toned colour went just a bit oddly with the gayer fabric of the chair coverings Rock Point favoured. The table at the centre of the cabin was buried under charts, dividers and compasses, and Zastro Timkin, his new secretary, sat at his small desk to one side, pen scratching as he annotated his minutes of the High Admiral's last conference. The cabin door opened, and Rock Point's even newer flag lieutenant ushered another officer through it. Lieutenant Harlan Mazingale had stepped into Lieutenant Erakson's position less than 2 5-days earlier, and he still seemed out of place aboard a Carisian warship. Not because of any lack of competency, but because his fair hair, blue eyes, and pronounced Chisholmian accent remained such a novelty here in Old Caris. They were becoming more commonplace, though, as more and more Chisholmians enlisted in the Navy. It was surprising, really. Given the Royal Army's traditional prestige in Chisholm, Rock Point would have expected any adventurous young lad from that island to have been army mad, not drawn to a naval career. As things were working out, though, he had actually received an only half-humorous protest from the Duke of Eastshire, the Imperial Army's commander, about the Navy's poaching on his private preserve. "Probably has something to do with the fact that we've kicked the Loyalists' asses at sea every time we've crossed swords," he thought. "Except," he corrected himself much more grimly, "where Thirsk is concerned, of course." That thought hit harder than usual as the overland convoy carrying Gwilym Manthir and his men crept steadily towards Zion. Grief for a friend and anger at his own helplessness seethed just below the surface for a moment, but he made himself push those emotions back into the depths. It felt disloyal, yet there wasn't anything he could do to change what was going to happen, and Gwilym wouldn't have thanked him for letting friendship distract him from his own duties and responsibilities. "Captain Yearley, High Admiral," Mazingale announced, and Rock Point nodded. The young Chisholmian was still feeling his way into his duties, although one might not have supposed that from his confident demeanour. He wasn't yet as familiar with his admiral's professional and personal relationships as he might have been, however, and he'd decided, wisely, in Rock Point's opinion, to err on the side of formality until he got them all straightened out in his own mind. "So I see," Rock Point said, and smiled at the young man. "For future reference, Harlem, Sir Duncan is an old acquaintance. I know him well, so be sure you keep an eye on the silverware when he's around." Mazingale's nod of acknowledgement bobbled noticeably on the last sentence. He froze for just a moment, then completed the movement. "I'll strive to bear that in mind, sir," he said, and Rock Point chuckled. "See you do," he said, then held out his right hand to Yearley. "I'm going to stay moored right where I am. Rank has its privileges, and I'll be damned if I'll clump around when I don't have to. Sit." He pointed with his left hand while the two of them clasped arms, and Yearley settled into the indicated chair with a small smile of his own. He was a naturally less demonstrative man than Rock Point, and more than one of his fellows had put him down as a dour, fussy warrior. There might actually be some accuracy in that, the High Admiral thought, but only a very small accuracy. "How's destiny coming?" he demanded, coming straight to the point.
The dockyard says I can have her back Thursday,
Yearly shrugged.
I'll believe that when I see it, but I think we probably will be able to warp her out to the roadstead sometime in the next 5 days or so. We're taking her gun deck guns back on board this afternoon. The carronades will be coming aboard tomorrow morning, and I'm reasonably satisfied with her repairs. The sail loft's running behind, though. That's why I'm doubtful about Thursday. Once they get the new canvas delivered, though, we'll be in reasonably good shape.
Careless of you to break her that way in the first place, Rockpoint said with a broad smile, and Yearly smiled back with considerably less amusement.
So you'll be ready to take her back to sea before the end of the month?
The High Admiral continued.
I don't think we'll be anything like properly worked up by then. But yes, sir.
Yearly's shoulders shrugged very slightly.
I've got a lot of inexperienced men and outright landsmen to turn into trained seamen somehow, and getting them to sea is probably the best way to be about it.
You're not the only one with that problem, believe me, Rockpoint said sourly. He looked out the quarter windows at the busy panorama of King's Harbour. The only thing worse than figuring out where to get the men we need is figuring out how to pay them once we've got them. He grimaced. I used to think it was funny watching Brian and Ironhill arm wrestling over the budget. Somehow it's not so humorous anymore. He gazed at the anchorage for another moment, then turned back to Yearly. Did you go over those notes I sent you about Alfred's new high-angle guns?
Yes, sir. Very interesting stuff, although I was a bit at a loss as to why you were telling me about them.
Rockpoint raised an eyebrow, and Yearly shrugged.
It was pretty obvious he must have been working on them for some time, especially if they're as close to ready to deploy as your memo suggested. Since I hadn't heard a whisper about them, and no one else had either as far as I know, I have to assume they were another one of Baron Seamount's top-secret, cut-your-own-throat-after-reading projects. Not the sort of thing a galleon captain would really need to know about, I'd have thought.
No? Rockpoint smiled a bit oddly.
Well, you did a good job convincing Jarrus to stay in port when Harpar and Sun Rising came calling last year, Duncan. He went on in an obvious non sequitur. And even with that little excitement of yours in Scrabble Sound, you've done even better since. So I'm afraid I'm taking destiny away from you, in a manner of speaking.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Yearly's tone was considerably sharper than he usually allowed himself, and Rockpoint smiled slightly.
I said, in a manner of speaking, he pointed out, which is my way of telling you. You've been promoted to Rear Admiral.
Congratulations, Duncan.
Yearly's eyes widened, and the High Admiral chuckled.
I hate to say this, but you didn't get your streamer just because we need flag officers so badly with all this sudden expansion. You also got it because you damn well deserve it. Frankly, it's overdue, but we also need good galleon captains, and you're one of the best we've got. As a matter of fact, I actually hesitated about submitting your name to His Majesty, not because of any reservations on my part, but because I'm only too well aware of how badly we're going to need those same good captains to lick all these newcomers into shape.
I'm honoured, sir,
Yearly said after a moment. Although I'm going to hate giving up destiny. If I may, Lieutenant Lathick's overdue for promotion, and he, to repeat myself, I did say you'd be giving her up in a manner of speaking, Duncan. I assumed that given your choice of flagships, you'd probably pick her. Was I correct?
Yes, sir, of course.
Well, unless I'm mistaken, it's still a flag officer's privilege to request the flag captain of his choice. Now, I'd assumed someone of your well-known demanding disposition wouldn't have put up with someone like Lathick unless he was at least marginally competent. If I was wrong, if you really want him promoted to, say, commander and given one of the new brigs instead,
I suppose I could go back to His Majesty and change my current recommendation.
And that recommendation would be precisely what, sir?
Yearley regarded his superior with a distinctly suspicious expression.
That he be promoted to captain immediately, and assigned as HMS Destiny's commanding officer.
Upon a mature consideration, sir.
I see no reason you should put yourself to the trouble or inconvenience His Majesty by changing your recommendation.
I thought that was how you'd see it, Rockpoint chuckled, then heaved himself to his feet.
Come, take a look at the chart.
He crossed to the table, Yearley at his side, and the two of them gazed down at the huge chart of the Gulf of Mathias and much smaller Gulf of Jaras. Rockpoint leaned over and thumped an index finger on Silkier Bay.
As you'll know better than most, we've got an awful lot of Silkian galleons moving in and out of Silktown with Carisian cargoes, he said. Now, I've never been one for subordinating military decisions to economic ones. But in this case, we're talking about a big enough piece of our total trade to make anyone nervous. To be honest, that's one reason we've stayed away from...
His fingertips slid down to the southwest and tapped once.
Desnair and the Gulf of Jaras. We're not certain why Clintan hasn't made a bigger push to shut down the Silkians and the Sidomachians' defiance of his embargo. And we haven't wanted to do anything to draw his attention to Silktown or change his mind in that regard.
It's not just good for our own manufactories and merchant marine, Duncan. It's steadily undermining the Group of Four's authority in both the Republic and the Grand Duchy, and it's simultaneously drawing more and more Sidomachians and Silkians into our arms, whether they realize it or not. Nonetheless, he tapped the city of Ithria. It's time we did something about the Desnarian fleet. Even after the Battle of the Markovian Sea, we actually don't have much better than parity with the combined Desnarian and Dalaran fleets. I'd like better numbers than that, of course, but while Garth Bay and Ithria are barely 1,300 miles apart in a straight line, they're damn near 17,000 miles apart as a ship sails. That's just a tad far for them to be supporting one another if we should decide to concentrate our strength in order to overwhelm one of them in isolation, wouldn't you say? He raised his eyebrows, and Yearley heard something suspiciously like a snort of amusement from Zastrow Timkin's direction.
Yes, sir, I think I'd agree with that, the newly promoted admiral replied. I'm glad to hear that, because next month you're going to help me take advantage of that little fact. In fact, you're going to be carrying my dispatches to Admiral Shane ahead of the rest of the fleet. And I'm sending some new ships with you, which is why you got that memo about the high-angle guns you were wondering about.
Rockpoint smiled, and this time there was no humor at all in the expression.
3. Royal College, Tellersberg Palace, City of Tellersberg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
Dr. Razier Macklin looked up as someone knocked on his office door.
Yes.
Father Pater is here, Doctor. His senior assistant, Derek Bowave, announced through the closed door.
Ah, excellent, Derek. Please show the father in.
Macklin stood behind his desk, beaming as Bowave escorted Pater Wilson into his office. It was the first time the intendant had actually visited the Royal College, and Macklin knew most of his colleagues were a little nervous about his decision to do so now. They'd skirted the edge of what Mother Church deemed acceptable knowledge for so long that having the official keeper of the Inquisition in Old Caris actually in their midst was disconcerting. Of course, those worried colleagues of his didn't know everything he knew about Pater Wilson.
"Come in, Father." Macklin held out his right hand. "It's an honor to welcome you."
"And it's a privilege to be here, Doctor," Wilson took the proffered hand, and Macklin surveyed the younger man's expression carefully. Wilson was obviously aware of his intense regard, but he only looked back, meeting the older man's eyes levelly. "I've been away from my own office too long," he continued. "But there are times when anyone needs a bit of a sabbatical. A retreat to think things through and settle oneself back down, you might say." "I understand entirely, Father. Please have a seat." Macklin escorted Wilson to the armchairs arranged across a small table from one another near one of the large office's windows. They sat, and Bowave set a tray on the table between them. It held two tall, delicate glasses and a crystal pitcher beaded with moisture, and Wilson's eyebrows rose as he beheld it. "A sinful luxury, I know, Father," Macklin said wryly. "For decades I was perfectly happy living a properly ascetic, scholarly existence in the old college down by the docks. Then it burned to the ground, and His Majesty insisted we relocate to the palace. Little did I realize that would be just the first crack in my armor of austerity." He poured chilled lemonade into the glasses, and ice. Actual ice, Wilson realized, tapped musically against the inside of the pitcher. "His Majesty insists we take advantage of his hospitality," the doctor said, handing a glass to his guest, "which includes the Royal Ice House. I tried manfully, I assure you, to resist the temptation of that sinful luxury, but my younger granddaughter Edith discovered its existence, and I was doomed. Doomed, I tell you." Wilson laughed and accepted the glass, then sipped gracefully. Ice and ice houses had been much more easily come by in the cool northern land of his birth than in excessively sunny Caris. There was ice on the very tallest mountains even here in Caris, and even in summer. But getting to it was far more difficult, and there were no conveniently frozen winter lakes from which it might be harvested either. That made it a scandalously pricey luxury in Tellersburg. "Will there be anything else, Doctor?" Bowave inquired, and Macklin shook his head. "No, Derek. I think the father and I will manage just fine. If I do need anything, I'll call, I promise." "Of course." Bowave bobbed a bow in Macklin's direction, then bowed rather more formally to Wilson. "Father Pater," he said, and withdrew, closing the door behind him. "This is good," Wilson said, taking another swallow of lemonade. "And I do appreciate the ice, although it's really too expensive to be wasting on me." "That's what I told Edith when she discovered it," Macklin said dryly. "Unfortunately, young Zahn was in the vicinity at the time." He rolled his eyes. "I think Princess Mariah's a very good influence on him in most ways, but he's acquiring the habit of largesse, especially when she's looking and he can impress her with it. Mind you, she isn't impressed by it. She's too much her parents' daughter for that sort of nonsense, but he doesn't realize that yet. And he's a teenager who's discovered just how attractive his fiancée actually is. So, when he heard me telling Edith I thought it would be a bad idea, he insisted we make use of it. And, to be fair, if you pack it in enough sawdust, you can actually ship ice all the way from Chisholm to Tellersburg in the middle of summer and get here with as much as half of your original cargo, which, given the price in Tellersburg, is enough to make a very healthy profit. I suspect there's going to be an even stronger market for ice makers in Caris than there is for air conditioning when the time finally comes," Patrick said, looking across at his host. Macklin sat very still for a moment, looking back at him thoughtfully. Then he gave a slow nod. "I imagine there is, Father. And we could probably actually get away with a compressed air plant to manufacture it without worrying about the prescriptions. I'm sure Edward could even power it with one of his water wheels." "Please, Doctor." Wilson closed his eyes and shuddered theatrically. I can already hear the Temple Loyalists' outrage. Much as I like cold drinks, I'd really prefer to avoid that battle if we can. After all, his eyes opened again, meeting Macklin's, we're going to have so many others to fight first.
True, Macklin nodded again. May I ask how you feel about that, Father?
About kicking over the traces where the prescriptions are concerned? Wilson gave a short, sharp crack of laughter.
That doesn't bother me at all, trust me. Not now. But if you mean, how do I feel about discovering the truth about the Church and the Archangels, that's a bit more complicated.
There's still a part of me that expects the Rakurai to come crashing through the window any minute now for my daring to even question, far less reject, the will of Langhorne. And there's another part of me that wants to march straight into the cathedral next Wednesday and proclaim the truth to the entire congregation. And there's another part of me that's just plain pissed off at God for letting all this happen.
He paused, and then sat back in his chair and laughed again, far more gently, as he saw Macklin's expression.
Sorry, Doctor. I imagine that was a little more answer than you really wanted.
Not so much more than I wanted as more than I expected, Father.
I'm relieved to hear you're angry, though. It certainly beats some other reactions I could think of. As long as the anger's directed at the right targets, of course.
It took me a while to accept that same conclusion, Doctor. And I won't pretend I'm as comfortable as I was back in the days of my blissful ignorance. But I've also discovered at least a shadow of Archbishop Michael's serenity lurking in the depths of my own soul. Although it's going to be a while yet before I can be as tranquil about all of this as he is. On the other hand, I realized I wouldn't be angry at God unless I still believed in him, which was something of a relief. And along the way, I've also discovered my belief is even more precious in some ways because it no longer rests upon the incontrovertible proof of the historical record. I almost suspect that that's the true secret of the Archbishop's faith.
In what way? Macklin asked with genuine interest. He'd found himself slipping into what Owl's library records would have described as a deist mindset, and he didn't know whether or not to envy Michael Stainer's fiercer, more personal faith. The real secret of the strength of Archbishop Michael's faith is almost absurdly simple, Wilson told him. In fact, he's explained it to us dozens of times in sermons. Every time he tells us there comes a point at which any child of God has to decide what he truly believes. Decide what he believes, Doctor. Not simply accept, not simply never bother to question based on what everyone knows, or on the testimonies or the Archangel Chihiro's holy writ, but decide for himself. The young man who'd been a Schulerite shrugged. It's that simple and that hard, and I'm not quite there yet.
Neither am I, Macklin confessed.
I suspect very few people in history, whether here on Safehold or back on Old Terra, have ever matched our Archbishop's personal faith, Wilson pointed out.
A personal faith, which, thank God, doesn't prevent him from being one of the most pragmatic men I've ever met, Macklin said.
As long as we're not talking about something which would compromise his own principles, at least, Wilson agreed.
And you feel the same way?
Macklin asked quietly. And I'm trying very hard to feel the same way, Wilson quirked a brief smile. I'm afraid I haven't quite decided where my principles are going to settle now that I've learned the truth. In fact, I'm afraid I'm discovering that I have very few principles, or hesitations at least, when it comes to considering things to do to those bastards in Zion.
I can work with that,
Macklin said with an answering and far colder smile. Of course, I've been thinking about it for a while longer than you have.
True, but I have a very personal motivation for seeing every one of them dangling at the end of a rope, just like those butchers in Farad.
By the oddest turn of fate, I believe that's precisely what their Majesties and Captain Athroy's have in mind, Father.
In that case, why don't we see what we could do to expedite that moment?
Wilson's naturally warm eyes were as cold as the grey ice of Xingwu's passage in winter.
I've been giving some thought to Commander Mandrain and Baron Seamount's more recent ideas, and even more to Master Hausman's. I don't believe the Baron's notions are going to present any serious problems, but Master Hausman's getting close to the prescription's limits. I can probably cover his interest in hydraulics by an extension of my attestation for his accumulators, but his proposed steam engines clearly cross the line into exactly the sort of knowledge Zhao Zheng and Langhorne wanted to make certain we'd never go anywhere near.
I was afraid you'd say that.
In my present mood, that's actually a powerful recommendation for building the things tomorrow, Wilson said dryly. Nonetheless, we're obviously going to have problems if we don't prepare the ground carefully. Fortunately, all the years I spent condemning intendants and inquisitors who connived at getting around the prescriptions in return for the proper considerations gave me all sorts of examples of logic chopping when I approached my new task, and it occurred to me that if I simply borrowed a page from their book, the steam engine problem might not be so insurmountable as I'd first thought.
Indeed.
Macklin leaned back and raised his eyebrows hopefully.
Of course not, Wilson assured him. It's very simple, Doctor. We've used steam and pressure cookers since the creation in things like food preparation and preservation. There's nothing new or tainted about generating steam. Who could possibly object to someone's doing that? And, when you come right down to it, producing steam the way Master Hausman is proposing is simply a way of generating wind pressure on demand, isn't it?
Of course it is.
And we've used windmills since the creation, too. For that matter, wind is one of Zhao Zheng's allowable trinity of wind, water, and muscle. So, except for the novel notion of making wind where and how it's most urgently required, I see no barrier under the prescriptions to the development of Master Hausman's new device.
He leaned back in his own chair and smiled broadly at his host.
Do you? He asked.
4. King's Harbour, Helen Island. Navy Powder Mill No. 3, Big Tyrian Island. And Tellersburg Palace, City of Tellersburg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
Have you got those new fuse notes for Master Hausman, Irvin?
Right here, sir, Irvin Mandrain said, patiently tapping the leather briefcase clasped under his left arm with his right forefinger.
And I also have the improved high-angle gun sketches, and the memoranda High Admiral Rockpoint wants me to deliver, and the memo from Baron Ironhill, and your invitation for him to dine with you when he visits Tellersburg next month.
He smiled at his superior and raised his eyebrows innocently.
Was there anything else, sir?
You,
Sir Alfred Heinrich, Baron Seamount said severely, swivel chair squeaking as he leaned back, the better to contemplate the commander.
Are an insubordinate young whelp, aren't you?
Never, sir.
Mandrain shook his head, expression more innocent than ever.
How could you possibly think such a thing? After working with you for the last couple of years, Seamount snorted. Trust me, it's easy.
I'm shocked to hear you say that, sir, Mandrain said mournfully.
Disappointed if I didn't, more likely.
Mandrain only grinned, and Seamount chuckled. Sunlight poured into the Baron's office. He had a marvellous view out over King's Harbour from his windows,
although some people might have felt just a little uncomfortable knowing that the fortress main powder magazine was directly underneath them. The slate wall panels were covered with their usual smudgy chalked notations, at least a quarter of which were in Mandrain's handwriting, not Seamount's. Stacks of memos and folders of correspondence littered the Baron's desk in seeming confusion, although Mandrain knew they were actually carefully organized. "Are you sure my absence isn't going to knock anything off schedule, sir?" the commander asked more seriously, and Seamount shrugged.
"I realize this may come as another shock to you, Commander, but I'd been looking after myself on my own for quite some time before you happened along. I imagine I'll be able to fumble through somehow until you get back," he said dryly.
Mandrain nodded, although he and Seamount both knew he'd been gradually assuming more and more responsibilities as Seamount's assistant and executive officer. What High Admiral Lock Island had called a chief of staff. And a trip to Edward Houseman's massive foundry complex wasn't exactly a jaunt to Tellisburg either. It was well over 800 miles, which would take a full 5 day each way. That was going to take a serious bite out of Mandrain's usual schedule, and a lot of additional work was going to end up dumped on Seamount's desk while he was away.
"I think we've got everything covered," the Baron went on, more serious now. "I won't pretend it's not going to be a pain, and I don't want you away any longer than you have to be, but we've been letting stuff that needs to be handed off to Master Houseman pile up too long because both of us were too busy to make the trip. If we're going to meet High Admiral Rockpoint's schedule, we can't afford to let that go on, which means one of us has to go, since no one else is cleared for all of this material, and I just plain can't. Which is why..." He gestured at the briefcase under Mandrain's arm, and the commander nodded.
"Yes, sir. I think Master Houseman and I can probably cover everything in one day, and I promise I'll get back here as quickly as I can."
"Quickly is good, but the whole point of this trip is to give Master Houseman the chance to ask any questions he needs to face to face. Don't rush your meeting with him. Better to take an extra day, or even 2 or 3, than for one of us to have to make the same trip again."
"I understand, sir."
"I'm sure you do. And give your cousin my regards."
"I will, sir."
"Good. Now go."
Seamount pointed at the office door, and Mandrain smiled, saluted, and obeyed the command.
"Irvin, this is a surprise,"
Trey Sullivan said as the yeoman ushered his cousin into his office.
"I didn't know you were coming."
"I'm on my way to see Master Houseman," Mandrain explained, crossing the office to clasp Sullivan's offered forearm. "Big Tyrion's not very far out of the way, so I thought I'd drop by."
"I see."
Sullivan tilted his head to one side, regarding his cousin speculatively. Mandrain's intensity and energy frequently fooled people into thinking he was impetuous, or at least impulsive, but Sullivan knew better. While he might be prone to rushing off in 2 or 3 directions at once, the commander had a remarkable ability to keep everything he was doing organized, balanced, and far more tightly scheduled than anyone else realized. The term multitasking was one of many which had been lost on Safehold, but if there'd been anyone on the planet it applied to, it would have been Irvin Mandrain. That was something he had in common with Baron Seamount, which was one of the many reasons the two of them complemented one another so well. But it was also the reason Sullivan rather doubted his cousin had just decided to drop in on him. True, Big Tyrian Island did lie about midway between Helen Island and Port Ithmin, but Mandrain wasn't the sort to take time off for personal visits when he was on official business. Besides, he and Sullivan exchanged letters on a regular basis, so it wasn't as if they had a lot of private family matters to catch up on.
"Are you going to be here overnight?" he asked.
leading the way to the windows overlooking Edith Sound, the channel between Big Tyrian and the mainland portion of the Duchy of Tyrian. Although Sullivan's command, officially Navy Powder Mill No. 3, but more generally known as the Hayratha Mill, was officially part of the port city of Hayratha, it was actually located over a mile north of the main port. For fairly obvious reasons, really, given the nature of what it produced and the quantities in which it produced it. At any given moment, there was a minimum of several hundred tons of gunpowder in the Hayratha Mill storage magazines, and no one wanted those magazines too close to a major city. Then there was the minor fact that Hayratha was one of the Navy's main bases and dockyards. Losing that would have been just a trifle inconvenient as well, he supposed. "Probably not overnight," Mandrain said, following him to the window and gazing across the 26-mile-wide sound at the green blur of the mainland. "I've got a lot to discuss with Master Hausman, and Baron Seamount needs me back at King's Harbour as quickly as I can get there." "I see," Sullivan said again, and turned to face him. "So why do I have the feeling you didn't come 4 or 5 hours out of your way just for a family visit with one of your favourite cousins?" "Because I didn't," Mandrain half sighed. "Then why did you come, really?" Sullivan raised an eyebrow, and Mandrain shrugged. "Because I came across a discrepancy I hope is just a clerical error," he said.
"You hope it's a clerical error?"
"Well, if it's not, then I think we may have a fairly significant problem." "You're beginning to make me nervous, Irvin," Sullivan said frankly, and Mandrain shrugged again. Then he set his briefcase on the window ledge in front of him, opened it, extracted a sheet of paper and handed it across. Sullivan accepted the sheet and tipped it slightly to catch the better light from the window, and squinted nearsightedly as he looked at it. Then he raised his eyes to his cousin's face with a perplexed expression.
"This is what you came to see me about?" He waved it gently. "Last month's production return and shipping summary?"
"Yes," Mandrain said flatly, and Sullivan frowned.
"I don't understand, Irvin. What about it?"
"It's wrong."
"Wrong?" Sullivan's frown deepened. "What are you talking about? What's wrong with it?"
"There's a discrepancy, Trey," Mandrain said. "A 45-ton discrepancy."
"What?"
Sullivan's frown disappeared and his eyes widened abruptly. "The amount you shipped doesn't match the amount you delivered. Look at the numbers for the June 15th shipment." Mandrain tapped the top of the sheet. "You loaded 1,075 tons of powder in a total of 6 shipments. But when the individual quantities of each shipment are totaled, they only come to 1,030 tons. He tapped the foot of the sheet. "There's 45 tons missing, Trey."
"That's ridiculous," Sullivan said.
"That's what I thought too," Mandrain replied. "So I checked the numbers 3 times, and they came out the same way each time." He shrugged and smiled crookedly. "You know how I am. I couldn't get my brain to turn loose of it. So I pulled the detail sheets and went over the numbers in each shipment's individual consignments one by one. And I found the problem right here, I think." He leaned over the sheet and found the specific entry he wanted. "Right here. Somebody dropped a decimal point. I think this was supposed to be a 50-ton consignment, but it's listed as only 5 tons. So somebody just made a mistake, is what you're saying?"
"Like I said, I hope it's just a clerical error, but this shipment was supposed to come to King's Harbour, Trey. So I went and checked, and 5 tons is exactly what we received. So either you have an extra 45 tons of gunpowder still in inventory here at Hayratha, or else we have 45 tons of unaccounted-for gunpowder floating around somewhere."
"Langhorne." Sullivan looked at his cousin, face pale. "I hope to God you're right about its being a clerical error.
Give me just a second.
He crossed to his desk, sat, and pulled a pair of thick ledger books from one of its drawers. He picked up the reading glasses from the corner of his blotter, perched them on the tip of his nose, and consulted the sheet of paper Mandrain had handed him. Then he set aside the topmost ledger book, opened the bottom one, and ran his finger down one of the neatly tabulated columns. "According to the manifest, your missing gunpowder came out of Magazine 6," he said, looking up over the top of his glasses. His colour was a little better, but his expression remained drawn. "Assuming it's a clerical error, and the additional 45 tons was never loaded, that's where it should still be. I assume Baron Seamount would like me to go see whether or not it's still there." He managed a wan smile, and Mandrain chuckled. "Actually, I haven't discussed it with the Baron yet," he said. "To be honest, I'm almost certain it really is a simple error. We'd certainly only requested 5 tons, not 50, but I figured this was the sort of thing I should make sure about, and since I was going to be headed up this way, it seemed simplest to discuss it with you personally. Assuming it is an error, you're the one in the best position to straighten it out. And on the off chance that it isn't an error, that somebody's playing clever buggers with our powder shipments, the less attention we draw to it until we've figured out what's going on, the better."
"Langhorne. Irvin, you didn't even mention this to Baron Seamount?"
Salavan took off his glasses and shook his head at his cousin.
"If someone's playing clever buggers with something like this, we need to get him and Baron Wave Thunder informed as quickly as possible. That's a lot of gunpowder."
"I know. I just wanted to make sure it really was missing before I started running around screaming," Mandrain said. "I mean, clerical errors far and away the most likely answer. And I didn't want the Baron, either of the Barons, now that I think about it, to think I was getting hysterical over nothing."
"Well, I suppose I can understand that."
Salavan closed the ledger and stood, resting one hand on its cover for a moment while he frowned down at it, his eyes anxious. His face remained pale and drawn, and he seemed to be thinking hard, Mandrain noticed, and it was hard to blame him. As he had said, 45 tons was a lot of gunpowder, enough for almost 10,000 full-charge shots from a long 30-pounder. And the notion that he might have lost track of that much explosives had to be a sobering reflection. Then the captain drew a deep breath and crossed the office to take his sword belt from the wall rack. He buckled it and settled it methodically into place, took down his hat from the same rack, and turned to his cousin.
"Come on. The simplest way to see whether it's there or not is to go take a look. Care for a walk?"
"Stop," Captain Salavan said as he and Mandrain reached a heavily timbered, locked door set into a grassy hillside. A small, green-painted storage shed stood beside the door, and the captain opened its door.
"Here."
He took a pair of felt slippers from a pigeonholed shelf with 2 dozen compartments and handed them across.
"These should fit, if I remember your boot size. Speaking of which, boots, I mean, they get left here."
He pointed into the shed, and Mandrain nodded. Both of them removed their navy boots, setting them under the shelving, then pulled on the slippers. Despite every precaution, the possibility of loose grains of powder on the magazine floor was very real, and a spark from an iron shoe nail, or even the friction between the leather sole and the floor, could have unpleasant consequences. Salavan waited until Mandrain had his slippers on, then unlocked the magazine door.
"Follow me," he said, and led the way into a brick-walled passageway.
There was another heavy locked door at its end, and a lighter door set into the passageway's side. Salavan opened the unlocked door into a long, narrow room. Its right wall, the one paralleling the surface of the hillside into which the magazine had been built, was solid brick, but its left wall was a series of barred glass windows, and a half-dozen large lanterns hung from hooks in its ceiling. Sullivan drew one of the new Shanwei's candles from his pocket, struck it on the brick wall, and lit two of the lanterns from its spluttering, hissing flame. "That should be enough for now," he said. He waved out the Shanwei's candle, moistened his fingertips, and pinched them together on the spent stem to be sure it was fully extinguished, then stepped back out into the passageway and closed the side door behind him. He made sure it was securely shut before he unlocked the inner door, and Mandrain heartily approved of his caution. The last thing anyone wanted inside a powder magazine was a live flame, which was the reason for the lantern room. The light spilling through its carefully sealed windows would provide them with illumination without actually carrying a lamp into the magazine itself. At the same time, the possibility of powder dust drifting out of the opened magazine and into the lantern room was something to be avoided. It was far less likely to happen now than it would have been just 3 or 4 years ago, of course. The new grained powder didn't separate into its constituent ingredients the way the old-fashioned meal powder had, which meant it didn't produce the explosive fog powder shipments had all too often trailed behind them. But as someone who worked regularly with explosives, Mandrain was in favour of taking every possible precaution where this much gunpowder was concerned. Sullivan opened the inner door. This one fitted with felted gaskets, and the two of them entered the magazine proper. Barrels of powder were stacked neatly, separated by convenient avenues to facilitate handling them with all the caution they deserved. It was cool and dry, just the way it was supposed to be, and Mandrain stood for a moment, allowing his eyes to adjust fully to the relatively dim illumination coming from the lantern room. "It looks pretty nearly full," he said. "How are we going to tell if—" His voice cut off abruptly, as the point of his cousin's sword drove into the back of his neck, severing his spinal cord and killing him almost instantly.